I'm going to call to order the March 16th Civil Law Committee meeting. We do have a quorum. Ms. Vaught will note the roll. Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes from the Friday, March 12th meeting. I'm sure you've had time to review the 15 pages of minutes from our day-long meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Minutes are adopted. The next item on our agenda is House File 2491, which is technically a Senate file in front of us at this time. The Senate File 2498 has passed the Senate, and the House has given its first reading and referred to this committee. So we'll lay the House bill aside, and we'll be acting on the Senate file. And so I will move Senate File 2498 to be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. I'm looking for Representative Paymar.
All right.
He's first. You're next. Welcome to the committee, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I lost. Can I just get a page to
Alicia?
Madam Chair, this is a very a simple bill. It basically makes ex parte orders for protection where there's immediate and present danger as alleged, and temporary restraining orders for no contact effective when signed by a referee. This is particularly problematic in Ramsey and Hennepin County, where referees will hear a temporary protection order, but then the order has to be countersigned by a judge, which can make things difficult for victims and when there's not judges available to countersign the order. So this would just change that in statute. And briefly, to speak to the bill, is Judge Chuck Porter from Ramsey County, and I also have with me Ellen Aide from the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, if they could just briefly address the bill.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Judge, if you'll state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Judge Chuck Porter. I'm the district court in Hennepin County.
Thank you. If you'd like to continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is an issue relating to dignified treatment of litigants in this court. Right now, most of the civil orders are heard by referees in the family division, and they have to be countersigned. That's imposes a delay in the case of a couple of hours to a day, perhaps, in terms of getting the signed order completed. We save approximately $20,000 a year by having referees in our court as opposed to judges. It saves us money. It's the place where the sort of the repository of the ongoing information in the family law resides with the referees. They're the most qualified to do this work, but it's just a matter of the expediency and the treating litigants fairly and expeditiously by allowing the referee's order to be final on original signing. I would say that, just as a matter of information, that we spend about 0.7 of a judge equivalent countersigning referee orders throughout the Hennepin County District Court. So this is not an insignificant amount of time saving if you would pass this relief for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record.
Yes. My name is Ellen Aide. I'm an advocate with the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. And our organization assists hundreds of women each year to obtain orders for protection. Last year in Ramsey County, there were about 2,400 orders written. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 2491. This bill would eliminate the need for a counter signature by a judge after a referee signs an emergency ex parte order for protection. Currently, the final order for protection is valid upon a referee's signature, while the ex parte is not. This bill would make the ex parte order for protection, the temporary emergency order, valid with a referee's signature. When an order has to be countersigned by a judge, it is often problematic for several reasons. When a victim gets an ex parte OFP and there is no judge available to countersign it, it cannot be served. Therefore, it's not valid. In the case of an order for protection, it means the victim must either go home to the possibility of further abuse or flee to friends, family, or a shelter. By this time, the respondent may suspect that the victim is getting an order and may flee. This further delays the process if you have to have it signed by publication instead of serving the person directly. Another problem is when the respondent has been arrested. There is a small window of time for a victim to obtain either an order for protection or a harassment order. Ideally, the order is served while the respondent is still in custody. If not, we go back to the possibility of publication if the respondent cannot be located. Another point I would like to make is that an order issued after a hearing and signed by a referee does not require a countersignature by a judge. It's only the ex parte order. The Domestic Abuse Act was created to provide immediate protection to victims of domestic violence. Obtaining an order for protection is imperative in securing the victim's safety. An order for protection function is to keep victims safe. A person who is already in crisis and at great risk of being imminently harmed should have access as fast as humanly and legally possible to a means of protection. And the ex parte order for protection and harassment restraining order are two of the best tools we have at our disposal.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the bill author or his testifiers? Representative Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Porter, do you have any idea what proportion of referee-signed orders are not, in fact, countersigned by the judge, or the judge has reviewed the order and determined that it's not appropriate to countersign?
Judge Porter.
Madam Chair, Representative Latz, it's an insignificant number. I would be very surprised if it was 10 in a year in Hennepin County.
Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, Judge Porter, out of how many total orders would you say?
Judge Porter.
Madam Chair, some number in the 6,000 to 8,000 range.
Any additional questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Latz.
Judge Porter, just so I make sure I understand the process, these are ex parte orders which provide for an automatic subsequent hearing for the subject of the order, or is a subsequent hearing available only at the request of the subject of the order?
Judge Porter.
Madam Chair, at the risk of having Chief Justice Blatz hear what I say here, the scheme in the bill is to only have hearings when requested. In Hennepin County, we have essentially ignored that scheme and have had a hearing in every case. So, I mean, I don't want to give you a truthful answer, Representative Blatz. I mean, our orders all provide for a hearing, although the bill's scheme is to only do it upon request. Those that are prepared by the advocates in Hennepin County and by our Domestic Abuse Service Center have that request in every one.
Madam Chair.
Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, Judge Porter, the bill's scheme or current law? Right.
The
now.
Current law.
Current law provides for a hearing only upon request.
Correct. By either party.
Okay. By either party. Okay. But regardless of the constitutional implications, the target of the order at least has the option of requesting a full hearing, presumably in front of a referee.
Or a judge.
Or a judge. And then one other
question.
Madam Chair, Judge Porter, what is the, does this proposed bill here cover harassment restraining orders as well?
Judge Porter.
Doesn't, should it?
Madam Chair, Representative Latz, it does cover the ex parte order in harassment cases. The bill has two sections. The proposed bill has two sections, one dealing with the orders for protection, the other dealing with harassment orders. And it applies only to the ex parte portion of that.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Seeing none, I will amend my original motion, and I will move that Senate file. I'm sorry, Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I was waving not very loudly. Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, Judge, are referees, are they officers of the court system? What is their qualification to be a referee? Could I come and be a referee?
Judge Porter.
given, Madam Chair, Representative Burrell, given some of the difficulties we've had in staffing those calendars on occasion, yes, you'd be welcome to come and be a referee, but the truth of the matter is they're full-time employees of the state court administrators, of the state court system. They're experienced, in the case of the referees in the family court, they're experienced family lawyers who've been hired by the court to work full-time in the family court. It's a full-time position with a staff and an office, and I don't know whether I'm answering your question, but...
Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, and thank you, and Judge Porter. That would mean that I would need to have a law degree, which I don't, so I couldn't be a referee.
Correct.
Judge Porter. Is anybody in the audience like to speak in opposition to this bill? President Kramer?
I just wanted to say that I apologize. I think I said that Judge Porter was a judge with Ramsey County, obviously Hennepin County. Judge Mott, who's a chief judge in Ramsey County, has sent a letter. He could not be told he is here.
No, there's
so if you have any questions, he is here.
Any additional questions? Members, I'm going to amend my original motion and move that Senate file 2498 be recommended to pass and refer to the consent calendar. Any additional questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
Next item on our agenda is House File 2641, Representative Harder. President Harder, I see an amendment in the packet for a DE1 amendment. Is that your amendment?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And would you like that adapted to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss?
I would, please, yes.
All right. Members, I'm going to move House File 2641 to be considered by the committee and then move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Harder.
Madam Chair and committee, my bill is the state response in response to a national effort to appropriate $1.5 billion for the promotion of marriage. This would be especially among low-income couples and would be for the purpose of training and helping couples to develop interpersonal skills that sustain healthy marriages. There's a growing body of statistical evidence that suggests that children fare best financially and emotionally in married two-parent families. This is an application that's been submitted by Dr. William Daugherty and Dr. Jody Dworkin. They're both professors and extension appointments at the University of Minnesota in family science area. And so we're hoping soon that the Minnesota Department of Human Services will be notified by the Office of Child Support Enforcement that a five-year Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood initiative has been approved. The purpose, as I said initially, is to encourage stable family formation among unmarried parents in Minneapolis and St. Paul and to promote healthy and successful marriages among unmarried couples who desire it, and to encourage responsible fathering to promote the economic and psychosocial well-being of children and to promote paternity establishment. National data indicate that about one-third of children born each year in the United States are born to unmarried parents. In Minnesota, the non-marital birth rate was about 26% in 2001, with 28% in Hennepin County and 34% in Ramsey County. The demographic characteristics of unmarried parents have changed in recent years, with about 40% of unmarried births occurring in cohabiting unions. That's up from 27% cohabiting in 1970. The risks associated with non-marital childbearing are well documented. Such things as lower levels of physical health, psychosocial well-being, economic well-being, and academic achievement being low among children. There are greater rates of poverty among the mothers and a lower likelihood of future marriage and less responsible fathering in terms of involvement and economic support. So we're looking at trying to help fragile families or potentially fragile families establish themselves as family with considerable community support This would involve volunteers. It would involve these extension personnel from the University of Minnesota. And it's called the Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Project, or we can call it for short the Family Foundation Project. There will be mentoring, support from faith communities, family of origin support where feasible, community-based parent education and couples education, access to premarital and marriage counseling and so forth, as involved as we encourage these couples to form families and make the commitment of marriage to each other and their children and become citizens and leaders in their community. I'll walk you through the details of the bill very briefly. We first of all ask that the Commissioner of Human Services develop and implement this initiative and using federal funds in the state appropriation that I'll talk about in a moment and in-kind services to establish this program to conduct a test a strategy for promoting marriage and responsible fatherhood among unmarried urban parents who expect or recently had a child. And we talked about the target population being those unwed parents in the metro area here for openers. We also, at the request of the Minnesota Association of County Officers, include a change in terminology for issuing licenses from marriage licenses to and work such as that to be conducted by district court administrators. Now is changed to local registrar. The disposition of the license fee changes in that an additional $5 would stay in the county to assist the local registrar in the necessary paperwork that would be required in helping to implement this. And $5 that would otherwise go to the general fund would go to the Healthy Marriage Initiative. The state of Minnesota hopes to accumulate over a five-year period $100,000 each year for the $500,000 match that the state would provide to make healthy families become a reality. It also requires the local registrar to make reports to the Department of Health on the number of licenses issued and the fees paid.
Thank you. Do you have anybody that wants to testify in support with you here today?
No, I don't. Thank
you. Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill? All right. Members, are there any questions for Representative Harder? Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Harder, on page 2 of the D1 amendment under implementation, I'm looking at lines 5 through 15.
A couple of questions. The on line 7, it says the initiative may be implemented through the University of Minnesota and community-based programs and organizations. Help me understand, what do you mean by it may be implemented through the U of M?
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, as it stands, the proposal that Minnesota has submitted, the work was done by these two doctors that I cited, Dr. Daugherty and Dr. Dworkin, in making Minnesota's application for eligibility for this federal match. So this would be permissive language, and with the intent that likely these two social scientists would be involved in implementing the program.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Harder, I also noticed it says on line 9 through 12 that the commissioner shall enter into contracts or manage a grant process for implementing the initiative. What provision in this bill or in current statute governs how the commissioner reports back to the legislature about these contracts or managing the grant process here?
Representative Harder.
Mr. Smith, I don't know that there is necessarily any reporting requirements per se and outlined formally.
And Representative Smith, this bill is headed to Health and Human Service Finance, and so the duties of the commissioner, I'm sure, will be looked at greater detail in that committee.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Any additional questions? Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, it doesn't appear to me that there's much civil law subject matter in this. There's no requirement that people have this counseling in order to enter a marriage. There are no penalties. It seems like it might be appropriate to have Chairman Bradley and his crowd look at it.
And Representative Pugh, it is going to Health and Human Service Finance. I think the issue related to this is the family law, family issues. I do have one question. How will the individuals that would be eligible for this program be targeted or contacted? Will they use birth records? Will they have signs up in hospitals? How will they do this?
Well, it's, Madam Chair, it's going to be a community-based kind of thing and involve unmarried parents who desire to become parents. I would think a logical outreach might be in the hospital's maternity ward. Just exactly how that is going to be implemented hasn't been clarified in the material I've seen.
And I'm assuming that the participation would be voluntary.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. This would be couples who desire to marry, very likely contacted before or shortly after the birth of their child. And no one is to be coerced into this, into marriage. That's certainly something we don't want to do. It's to be supportive of those who have intention and desire to form a marriage and a family.
All right, thank you. Any additional questions? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2641 be recommended to pass and referred to Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Representative Harder, you have the next bill on the agenda as well, which is House File 2642. My information shows that you would like that to go to the General Register. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have some handouts.
Certainly. Alicia? I'll move House File 2642 for consideration by the committee. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, just a minute. The copy that I have only has page one. Is that just in my packet, or are we all missing the complete bill?
Madam Chair, the DE1 amendment should be three pages.
There's a delete on it.
We're on House File 2642. Is there an amendment for this?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that point. Thank you, members. I'll move the DE1 amendment to House File 2642 to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. All right. Now I think we're back on track here. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill that's before you really recognizes that divorce is stressful for the couple involved in a divorce and stressful for the children involved in a divorce. And likely a divorce is something that's not done frequently, and so there are unfamiliar folks facing a difficult process and a difficult time in their life, and they may have questions about what are the alternatives, what resources are available, what is mediation, what about custody, what about child support. At the same time, they're trying to manage resolving conflicts, and oh yes, there's the children, their emotions and their stresses and their questions about life in a family that's changing. The Parent Education Bill, House File 2642, came about by the Supreme Court task force that helped to design parenting education classes. And there are several organizations that conduct these classes. And as you look at the bill, you'll see changes to current law. This cooperative parenting education bill requires that all parenting classes be a minimum of 8 hours. While current law requires a minimum of 4 to 8 hours. Parents, and as an example, Parents Forever class is currently a 12-hour class, and Dakota County uses an 8-hour class as a current practice. This bill requires all divorcing parents with children to go to the classes, while current law requires only parents with contested custody, support, or parenting time issues being required to go to the class. Required parties to attend the first parent class within 45 days as part of the service of summons. So the first part of the bill references that new requirement, so that that information on parenting classes reaches the couple in the early stages of their divorce proceedings. And it indicates in the summons where people can make contact, find out what is the availability of classes in their area. There are only two or three other states that have pocket filings like Minnesota, and so that means that the parties don't have to file their divorce with the courts until they start the proceeding. And the action that starts the divorce is serving of the summons to the other party. So that's the reason for the additional language, so we get the information on attending the class to the couple early. The bill provides that upon request of a party and a showing of good cause, the court may excuse the party from attending the program. And this is helpful for people of limited financial means. The classes have been very helpful for people, and there's a large satisfaction rate. And the one sheet handout that's two-sided gives you some quotes from people who participated in Washington and Ramsey County Parents Forever class. And I think these comments are strong evidence of the benefits of the classes that are being made available to families. So people are getting a lot of great information at low cost. The classes help to reduce conflict between the parties, and people are more able to work out their issues instead of going into court. I have with me today four people who are going to testify. Who's going to go first?
Representative Carter, if I can, just for clarification purposes, when I originally viewed this bill, it was for contested cases, was my understanding, and now in the delete all amendment, this policy would make it for all divorce cases. Is that correct?
Divorce cases that involve children, yes, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
My name is Marilyn McKnight, and I am the director, owner of Erickson Mediation Institute. We've been in a training and mediation service since 1977. Since 1993, we have been providing family divorce education and parent education classes to divorcing people in Dakota County. And this class has been part of what was looked at when the law came into being on mandating parent education classes in contested custody cases. I wanted to explain what the classes are. The classes that we teach in Dakota County are the 8-hour classes, and we teach them in three sections. The first section is about, and it's 3 hours, 3 hours, and 2 hours is how we get to the 8 hours. The first section is about the emotional divorce process, helping people understand, as between the two spouses, why they are emotionally at such different places when they start a divorce, usually because one processes the emotions of divorce and loss much before the other one. And and in understanding that, beginning to have a little bit more understanding of each other and why they're at such different spots at the beginning of a divorce. We then talk about the legal divorce process, their choices about how they go about accomplishing a divorce, whether they litigate or they mediate their divorces, what their choices are, and answer their questions about all of that. We end up the evening talking about the three major areas of decision-making in a divorce, describing to people exactly what they're going to be looking at in terms of the issues they have to decide in a divorce. That the first class, we do evaluations at the end of each class. Routinely at the end of the first class, people's evaluations are lower. They're mad because they've been made to attend a class by law and not by choice. And what's been interesting is that over the three nights of classes, by the third class, the evaluations are highly appreciative that they've attended the classes. So starting out, they're a little bit hostile coming in, but by the end of the three classes, they're quite appreciative of having been there. The second class has to do with the effect of the divorce on their children. And it's a terribly important class whether they're in a contested divorce or not, because what people don't understand in divorce is that the thing that harms our children most in this society is the conflict between parents. And even people who settle how they're going to do their custody arrangement may have a lot of conflict between them and not really understand what their children need during the divorce and afterwards. So this part is terribly important. We talk about the effect of divorce on children from all of the research starting in the late 70s to the present. We don't actually go through all of that dry research, but we explain it. And then what parents need to do to help their children through the divorce and afterwards, and also what they must not do, the things that really, really do harm children that they never think about. They're also given information about what to expect from their kids at different stages of the children's development and helping them understand what the children are supposed to be doing in their developmental progress and then how the divorce interferes with that. Lastly, in that second class, we talk about domestic violence and the effect of domestic violence on children, so that by the end of the class, they've had a very, very heavy dose of all of the things that can happen to children in a divorce, and in fact do in the highly litigated custody battles that go on in our nation. But also they have a lot of information about what they can do to help their children do well during and after the divorce. The third class has to do with communication, and what we're doing in that class is trying to help them understand that a very funny thing happens in divorce when you have children, and that is that during and after the divorce, you have to be almost better parents than you ever were before. You have to learn how to communicate with each other, cooperate with each other around the children's needs, and make sure that you're growing up good, strong, healthy kids. And so that last class gives them a lot of information on how to better get along with each other, tips on how they can communicate better, some actual ideas on various things that people do to get information across to each other in that during and after the divorce when they're no longer living together. One of the interesting things I think that has happened in the years that we've been doing this divorce education class is that I wish I had kept track of the numbers of people who have come up after the classes are finished at the end of the third class and say something like, "You wouldn't believe it, but I just talked to my spouse, and he or she said she had just attended or he had just attended the classes, and we need to get together and do something different about our kids." And people will come in to mediation or a consultation in mediation and say, "You know, the classes were the best thing we ever did because it got us started to think about what's happening to our kids, and we've started to talk and do better things." I know that there's been some discussion about the cost of the classes in Dakota County and in several counties. I think the classes are very similar. We charge $20 per class, so it's $60 per person to attend the classes. And if people are on legal aid or unemployed or just walk in and say, "Honestly, I don't have $20, I can't come up with it," well, of course they're going to come into the class. I don't think there's any person who would say that they can't come into the class. And there's not any way that they wouldn't be, that their court order wouldn't be honored just because they couldn't pay. I think that there are certainly a lot of professionals who think the classes do a great deal of good. People who teach the classes in our program are not paid, but usually professionals in the areas of law, psychology, and therapy, and mediation all have codes of ethics that say that they need to do some public service or pro bono work. And so that's how we cover the fees. The fees that we receive from the classes cover the handouts, the scheduling, and returning information to the courts.
I'm going to interrupt here because you are about three-quarters of the way through your time allotment, and there's a number of testifiers and people in opposition.
Okay.
So, Representative Harder, I don't know how many more of your testifiers you need to testify, but I am on a schedule. I am going to complete my agenda today, and you need to use your 20 minutes in the way that you want.
I was just going to read. My name is Solveig Erickson. I was going to report on some of the research, and I'll do it very quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Generally, I've done a lot of collecting of articles over the years, research articles on these classes. And generally, parents who complete divorce education are better able to process situations with their children. They indicate a greater willingness to allow the child to spend more time with the other parent, which points to also they've found that there's a reduction in incidences where children are put in the middle of parental conflict. You know, the research is pretty vast and well documented about when parents take some time out from their own divorce process and think about the effects on kids and learn some things, they tend to keep their kids out of the middle. And that's really the goal. And that was the gist of what I was going to say.
Right.
And you
thank you.
Those. I do.
Alicia, I believe there's additional handouts to hand out. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peg Lindloff, and I am a family educator with District 622 Schools. I coordinate programming for the Parents Forever program, which is a Washington and Ramsey County collaborative where I have worked to coordinate Parents Forever classes for divorcing parents for over 4 years. The requirement of parent education as established can be met by a number of different programs throughout the state, and Parents Forever is one of those. It's a curriculum developed by the University of Minnesota Extension. It focuses on the children in each aspect of the curriculum. It is court approved. And Parents Forever programs serve divorcing families in 65 of the 87 counties in Minnesota. It reaches more than 3,000 participant families every parents each year. The program helps families develop skills to reduce the negative effects of divorce that have been previously discussed. In the collaborative that I represent, we offer Parents Forever as a 12-hour program offered in 6 2-hour or 3 4-hour sessions. We serve over 400 participants each year. Our experience has shown that offering divorcing parents or unmarried parents with contested issues a comprehensive program over a 6-week period of time results in the types of behavior changes intended by the original law. As a certified family life educator, I will testify that parents learn best when they have the opportunity to process what they have heard, try new techniques, and come back to the group with questions. Attitudes of most of the participants also change over the course of these weeks. I am not familiar with other parent education programs offered, but I do know that some of them can be completed in one day, and I am not convinced that the minimum standards of the statute can be successfully met through that structure. I have information about the University of Minnesota evaluation study. There's probably not time to discuss that here, but I would be happy to share that at some other time. One of the things that parents often comment about is that they wish they had gotten information sooner in the divorce process. And in the bill, I believe they have asked that it be started a lot sooner, which would be very, very good in my estimation. I would like to support the proposal to require participation for all parents with custody and parenting time issues, not just those with contested issues. Because Parents Forever focuses on parenting apart after divorce, I believe that all parents would benefit from participation. Many parents comment that they didn't realize some of the things they were inadvertently doing that hurt their children. In conclusion, I am supportive of House File 2642, and the proposal to require a minimum of 8 hours of parent education and to require all parents to attend. Making this more consistent statewide would encourage parents to participate sooner, would make the parent education a part of the divorce process for all parents, and I believe this will help all children who are involved.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lindoff. Are there any questions? This time I'd like to take testimony in opposition to House File 2642. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition? Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. My name is Michael D. Ditburner.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook, Chair. And I am testifying in opposition to this bill. I happen to be the chair of the Legislative Committee of the American Academy of Matrimonial Attorneys, Minnesota chapter. I also want to let the court know that the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section last Saturday has voted to oppose this legislation unanimously, as has our organization too. And I'll tell you why. And just briefly, the legislative history of this particular legislation is important. In 1995, this legislature passed a law, 518.157, that allowed judicial districts to adopt parenting education programs. In 1997, the legislature said that these parenting education programs should be in all judicial districts, and it authorized the Supreme Court of Minnesota to set up minimum standards. That same year, the Supreme Court did that, and they required all judicial districts for contested custody cases to require people to undergo 4 to 8 hours of parenting education. And that has been in effect since then. I want you to understand that our organizations, the vast majority of the people and attorneys in our organizations support parenting education. It works. It's beneficial for our clients. But we just happen to believe that this is a very, very bad piece of legislation that is going to interject a level of inflexibility into parenting education programs throughout the state by requiring them to be for a minimum of 8 hours and expanding their scope to all contested custody cases and also support cases, as is stated in this legislation. Other than the parenting education coordinators and teachers who have testified as witnesses at this particular hearing, there is no constituency out there for adopting this legislation. I heard scant testimony offered as to why the current statute is inadequate. And I heard no testimony whatsoever about how these parenting education program coordinators and teachers approached the Minnesota State Supreme Court and told them, look, your current minimum standards are inadequate. Please consider changing them. And how then the Supreme Court refused to listen to anything that they had to say. Why should the Supreme Court and not the legislature be the body that decides minimum standards? Because they have the ear of all the different court administrators throughout this state who can advise the Supreme Court about what works for their counties and what works for the people in their counties and whether they have enough money to be able to fund programs. When you expand the scope of the parenting education statute and you make it applicable to contested uncontested cases as well as contested cases, and I think there's probably about, I've heard the figure 15% of cases are contested, about 85% of cases are uncontested, and you make a minimum of 8 hours in every single county rather than 4 hours like the Supreme Court has currently said, the financial burden is going to have to fall on somebody, be it the individuals who are in the program, and by the way, the Supreme Court said that those fees should be as small as possible. Parenting education programs, such as the ones we have in Hennepin County, who are barely breaking even, or the counties themselves. And if the counties are going to pick up the slack of the cost of funding these programs to have additional volunteers, additional people doing this, then it's going to result in what is, in effect, an unfunded mandate.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ditburner. Sir, if you'd like to judge... Porter, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. You'd like to continue with your
Madam
testimony?
Chair, I'm Judge Chuck Porter, and I'm here also to speak in opposition to this bill. I would say, just by way of background, that I just recently completed my second three-year term as the chief judge in the family division in Hennepin County. So I've been the chief judge for six out of about the last 10 years. And I want to reiterate something that Mike just said. We have parenting education in the current scheme. The Supreme Court approves programs in the range of 4 to 8 hours, and at least in Hennepin County, the current program is not broken. I'm uncomfortable in the sense that Ms. Erickson's organization has been a wonderful organization for our use and has done great things, but to expand this by 6 to 10-fold over what we're now doing, to ask two organizations, Chrysalis and Storefront, who are doing these programs in Hennepin County and barely breaking even, to expand their program by roughly 50% in terms of its time, and to expand it to somewhere between 6 and 10 times as many people when they're basically just barely breaking even, to solve a problem that doesn't exist is not a practical solution to the issue. You know, this is about scant resources at a time when a family is trying to prove that two can live as cheaply as two, and they can't. This is about scant resources at a time when you're asking them to both go and neither one of them has access to weekend child care. This is about expanding this program in vastly increased numbers into the communities of color. And nobody has the kind of experience that we need to do. If we're going to have this in every support case, those cases predominantly involve the communities of color. And this is expanding this program from one that is predominantly a program of the middle class to a program that's going to be predominantly in the communities of color for the poor. About 70% of these kinds of cases that would be covered by this bill in Hennepin County, at least one party is self-represented. That means they can't afford a lawyer. And now we're going to ask them to make an additional contribution. I applaud the Erickson Mediation Institute's program that they do it at $60. We're currently doing it at $85. If you about double it, we're talking about some number in the $160, $170 range. And that's just a lot of money for this vastly increased group of cases that we don't now have. The final thing I want to say is one more practical thing, and that is we don't have mandatory filing in Minnesota. You're asking that this happen within 45 days of the service of the summons, but the lawyer doesn't have to file the case within 45 days of the service of the summons. So we're not in a position, that is, the court is not in a position to maintain any management over these cases whatsoever unless we have mandatory filing, and we don't.
I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Would you like to add your comments briefly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy Michelle with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. I just want to echo the comments of the other testifiers and just say that it's, as you know, we represent a number of low-income people across the state of Minnesota in family law matters, and it's already difficult for our clients who rely on public transportation, who have issues, you know, single parents with child care issues, who may not have flexible jobs that allow them to take time off to get to these classes to meet the current four-hour requirement. And to expand it to 8 hours and then expand it to the number of clients that it would apply to in uncontested cases now as well as contested would just be a serious burden on them. I would also say that in talking to our attorneys who practice outstate Minnesota, it's really difficult already with the very limited number of classes for folks to even get to them. Sometimes if you live in a real rural county, the closest class may be 50 miles away. It may only be offered one or two or three times a year. So this is extremely difficult, in particular for people in outstate Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard you talk about it's a four-hour program you've got down at Storefront. And
now,
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, we're at 5.5 hours for the Storefront and Chrysalis programs at this point.
Because I heard testimony earlier that it took them 3 hours to even like being there. And then after the second 3 hours, they start talking to each other. I don't know. It sounds like it's a force in favor of the opposition here. My other question is, you said right now it's for the middle class because they can afford to go, and so does that mean the ones that can't afford to go just don't ever get this kind of school education?
Judge Porter, Representative Wardlow, the reason I said it is for the middle class is because it now applies in our county only to contested dissolutions where the issue of custody is contested. If we now expand this to support cases, that the clientele in Hennepin County for support cases is largely from the communities of color and largely from the poor. And they are not getting education, but they don't have contested issues of dissolution-based custody either.
Don't their,
that was unavoidable.
Don't their children still benefit, wouldn't they?
Judge Porter.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I can't say that they wouldn't benefit. I'm sure there's incremental benefit for every minute that people spend in learning more about how to raise their kids. I can't honestly say that. The question is, you know, we have the same kind of anecdotal evidence coming out of our program where people say, I've learned in 5 hours or 4 hours to communicate better. I've learned the dynamics of divorce. It's just a matter of, is it practical to mandate this cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all for the state on top of programs that are not now broken?
Thank you. Members, I'm going to move to lay this bill on the table. What I'd like at this point is for Representative Harder to come and make some response to the concerns that were addressed. We will meet again on Friday. If we can get some resolution to this, I'm not going to do amendments or trying to fix things on the fly. I have a very full agenda, and so... unless there are very burning questions, I would ask the committee to withhold any additional questions. Representative Harder, you can make comment very briefly, and then we're going to move on today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a witness who would like to respond.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Nancy Versteg. I'm a professor at William Mitchell College of Law. Teach the family law course there and have authored an article on this topic as well as a casebook that deals, at least in part, with parent education. And I'm here to testify actually in favor of this bill. I understand that there are some logistical concerns that people have. I think we have to weigh those against the real benefits to kids. And in the environment we have today, we have so many parents who are unrepresented, who are kind of fending their way through the system on their own. And my concern is that these kids are not being parented by parents who are fully informed about the possible dangers to the kids. And if we look at the costs of conflict between parents at the time of divorce, it's very high. The kids who have the most trouble adjusting after divorce, who have juvenile delinquency, suicide, drug, serious problems, are kids of parents who've had ongoing conflict. And these classes really reduce the conflict. There are classes in, as of 2001, 35 states. Many states have more extensive classes than we do, some targeted at high-conflict families, domestic violence families, classes for kids. We're kind of on the lower end of service in this area. The studies are really overwhelming in terms of documenting across the United States the reduction in conflict, the increased cooperation, the quick settlement of cases, things that come out of this. So I think it's really important to balance the fact that, yes, we would certainly have to work out how things work. That was done when the bill was initially passed. But these programs really do work, and they really do benefit kids. And they benefit kids who aren't getting other services and parents who aren't having access to counsel, who aren't having access to other services. So I think it's something to consider. The other issue is the timing, which is what this bill, I think, really goes to, no matter what set of hours you set. For people to get the education after most of the divorce process is through is not very helpful. Habits are set. Kids are harmed. Patterns are in place. And it really makes sense to do this sooner. I don't see any reason why it couldn't be included in the summons that people would go to the classes or register for the next available class 45 days after service or receipt in the mail. I don't think that the pocket filing issue is really a barrier to doing that.
Thank you very much for your comments with that. I lay House File 2642 on the table. Next item on agenda is House File 2436. Representative Abler.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Abler. We have House File 2436 in front of us. If you could start by letting the committee know what portion of your bill is under the jurisdiction or comment of civil law, so that we might focus our attention on that area that is in the jurisdiction of this committee.
Madam Chair, I think the whole topic maybe, but the there's an amendment too, and just for your motions purpose, this will go to Commerce.
And if I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
This is going to go to Commerce. The motion would be to go to Commerce after this.
House File 2436, the Emergency Health Powers Act, is going to Commerce?
Yeah. Madam Chair, this is going to almost every committee we have except for, it's going to seven committees, Madam Chair.
Oh, aren't you lucky.
It's a merry-go-round.
Okay, and from what I understand, this is a bill that didn't make deadline, and I've gotten orders from headquarters to hear it this week.
Thank you,
and
Madam
so
Chair.
In working with Leadership Corner, you don't have to go to rules between. They just want you to keep moving. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're going to rules at the end.
Okay, I'll move House File 2436 be considered for the committee to recommended to pass and referred to Commerce.
And Madam Chair, someone would move Amendment A5. That's a technical correction having to do with the sunset. The bill as was existing had a 2-year sunset, which is why it's back this year. It was our intention to have a 4-year sunset after that. And this language technically clarifies that, to my understanding.
And so, members, the A5 amendment would make the Emergency Health Powers Act sunset in 4 years. Is that correct?
It sunsets already. This clarifies a better way to do the sunset.
All right. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. The A5 amendment is part of your bill. If you'd like to continue.
Madam Chair, just to maybe the Department of Health can clarify the civil law matters that they think would be interesting to you in about 2 minutes. Could you do a longer talk than that?
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. I do have a handout.
Alicia? Handle. There we go. Thank you.
And I can go quickly. I think there are many parts of the bill that do relate to the Civil Law Committee. The Public Health Emergency Act allows the governor to declare a public health emergency for 30 days. It authorizes that if the legislature is not in session, the legislature must be called into session and the legislature can terminate a declaration. It confirms rights of individuals to refuse testing and treatment. It specifies due process for placing individuals or groups of people under isolation and quarantine orders. And it requires certain conditions and care for those people to be handled in certain ways. There have been some questions that have been brought up about the powers or the authorization for isolation and quarantine. And on page 2 of the handout, there's some comparison of the authorizations of the Mentally Ill Commitment Act and the isolation and quarantine provisions. Under the isolation and quarantine provisions, the order is authorized only by the Commissioner of Health. Under mentally ill commitment, it can be done by a physician or a psychologist. The isolation and quarantine order, within 24 hours, the Commissioner must file with a petition with the court, and the court must act within 24 hours of receiving that petition. Under the Mentally Ill Commitment Act, there are 72 hours for that time period, and that includes weekends and holidays. The commissioner issues the order and peace officers provide transport. Under mentally ill commitment, there's a wide variety of people who can transport people to a facility and request a hold. The isolation and quarantine applies to only certain communicable diseases and only if a delay for a court order jeopardizes the ability to prevent or limit transmission. There's also some new provisions that have been requested for the 2004 law. One is addressing liability issues for volunteers. These would be volunteers to state or local government. They would be offered the same liability protection as if they were a government employee. If they are operating under emergency plans, they are acting within the scope of their limit and training. If we're in a situation where hospitals are overwhelmed and we're needing to provide care in high school gyms or armories, we would propose a Good Samaritan standard. The governor would issue a separate executive order, and we would move to the Good Samaritan liability standard, which is what's in place for people who stop and help on the side of the road. We have a proposal for security information, which are information such as the emergency plans, the location of supplies, or home or cell phone numbers of volunteers. There's some language around the peace officer may use reasonable but not deadly force in enforcing an isolation or quarantine order. It authorizes the peace officer to enforce a temporary hold, and it directs the commissioner and local public health to advise the peace officer on disease protection. It authorizes that court hearings can be held electronically, and it has a provision for job protection for people who are either voluntarily or ordered into isolation or quarantine. We look to the jury duty protection standard as a place to start for that. And it includes a separate requirement to work with local public health to address public health data needs, both the types of data to be collected in systems to manage and collect information about public health across the state. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Members, are there any questions?
Madam Chair, just to call out the areas that are probably, there's the tort liability and probably issues are some of the greatest ones. And then the as introduced, this has changed a lot. So if people have only read the as introduced, it's a different bill, at least in many components. We clarified occurrence. Maybe the department wants to clarify how the word occurrence was defined in terms of when the municipal liability standards would come into force. And maybe you can want to comment about that or should I just? Well, the question was, is an occurrence a bioterrorist act, and therefore the state, whatever liability standard is, $1 million divided by 20,000 people, which is nothing. And it's defined in here, the occurrence is what an individual does. So if there's an event, there could be many occurrences. At least that way there's a somewhat of a cap on the liability for the towns. Of the $1 million or $2 million cap, at least there's a finite cap. I tried to divide the, I'm nervous about liability issues, and I wanted to make sure the people had adequate protections. And so the occurrence is what a person does. And so I just wanted to call attention to you, and that's specified on line 3, I think, on page 3, let's see, 4. Oh, so on page 4, Madam Chair, lines 15 to 18. I thought that was a positive step trying to clarify what an occurrence was. So if you have any questions, we can stand for those.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to House File 2436? Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association just to create a legislative record on a couple of the pieces, and there is one question that I have about the bill and whether or not it's intended. I appreciate Representative Abler's efforts to clarify the occurrence as being the act of the individual volunteer, and we applaud that effort. I do have a question, though. On page 3, section 4, and the difficulty I'm having with that, Madam Chair and members, is that although the local government assumes the liability for the people that are responding to an emergency, my concern is that we have a body of law in Minnesota called vicarious official immunity. And whenever there is immunity that attaches to an underlying official, that immunity extends vicariously to the local unit of government. So you could have a tort that you're intending to compensate under this section. However, you would allow the local government or the state to argue that they are vicariously immune from any liability, and I don't think that's the intent, and I wanted to point that out to the committee so that we can create a record that that's not your intent. You want the government to be responsible and assume that liability, and that the government isn't ultimately immune as well. So I wanted to point that out, because right now, without clarifying that, no one has liability under the doctrine of vicarious official immunity. That's question number one. If you want to take that, that's mine, and then I have one other brief comment.
Thank you. Are there any questions on this point for Mr. Carlson?
No.
All right.
and Madam Chairman and members, on page 4.
Madam Chair.
Representative Adkins.
From that point, why don't we finish? I think the issue was more so for the author and whether or not that was his intent.
I think he stated that.
If he did, I didn't hear it.
Madam Chair, I can restate it. It's the intention. It's my intention to require that. If you read the bill carefully, you'll discover that when emergency is declared, that we've even reined in who can be covered by this under the local coverages, which in many cases I think are self-insured. But you have to be part of a plan, and you have to be working in areas that you know what you're doing, and there's a number of caveats. And my interest has been to protect the rights of the individual who might be harmed by somebody who they thought was going to help them. And so it's our intent that I've never heard the term vicarious official immunity before, which is why I come to these committees to learn. But it'd be our intention that they would be able to be compensated under the limits that are subject to, that are already in place by the municipal liability limits.
Thank you.
Did I say okay, Madam Chair?
I believe so.
Works for me.
All right, thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, and then on page 4, at the end of line 14, and all of 15, 16, 17, and 18, we had this discussion with the epinephrine bill yesterday, on Friday, and the issue of acting in good faith should be sufficient, and in that bill last week, we deleted the language regarding willful, wanton, or reckless manner. We deleted that because it's just has a confusing standard between good faith and willful, wanton, and reckless. And then on line 16 and 17 and 18, this would be the first time in my recollection that we would be providing Good Samaritan immunity to someone who actually gets compensated to do the work. And I don't think we've ever granted that where someone can be compensated for the activity and then still get Good Samaritan immunity. And I would point that out to the committee. I don't think we've ever done that any other place in law. With that, Madam Chair, that would be all the comments that we'd have.
All right. Representative Abler, would you like to comment?
Well, Madam Chair, civil law is not my area. I'm a health education guy, and I really like it that way. I like the room, but I... and so I'm actually looking for the advice of the committee on some of these matters. And I, as I read this, you know, I think that there's some good points raised by Mr. Carlson there. Maybe the Department of Health wants to comment. Part of this language was imported to me, and then we've tweaked up a number of parts. This part has not been worked over very thoroughly, though. So maybe members want to weigh in and offer me some advice.
All right. Thank you. I do have a question for either you or the department. Do you envision a situation in which you would have paid professionals working in these situations that would be covered under other... I mean, I'm assuming you're going to have doctors, et cetera, that are going to have their own liability insurance. So with that being the likely case, then explain to me why we need lines 17 and 18 on page 4.
Madam Chair, the Good Samaritan liability provision is comes into place only in a very specific situation. This is when the hospital is overwhelmed, there's no longer place to keep people, so we're having to care for people in high school gyms or armories or other places where you don't have access to equipment, you don't have x-ray, you don't have oxygen, you may not have sterile fields, and so we're operating in a very much a triage or a very emergency care kind of setting, and the setting may be very similar to what you may have available to you at the side of the road if you stop at a car accident. What we have heard from healthcare providers who have been working and developing and practicing and working in exercises is that they may be assigned to a facility or to a setting where they don't have access to supplies and equipment. They may be a nurse who's been assigned by her clinic or asked by her clinic to go work. They plan to pay her salary, but this is outside her usual care setting, outside her usual ability to have the access to the material. So it's not so much related to the payment as it is to the various different kind of setting. The funding issue we included there as a means of not prohibiting people from volunteering regardless of their payment status in a very, very difficult situation.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, two points. Number one, a volunteer is defined on page two to include only those people who are volunteering without the expectation of compensation. And so that's inconsistent with the answer because they're being paid. But secondly, and more importantly, to the extent they are acting in good faith, they are not liable for civil damages as a result of their acts or omissions. And that is just taking into consideration their circumstances when they don't have all their equipment, when they're not in the appropriate place. That's what the top half is expected to take care of. And to say that you can get compensated for that, and if you act in good faith, you don't have liability, period. Now to say that that you can get paid for your job, not be a volunteer, and pick up this immunity,
Mr. Carlson, I think Section 5 relates to responders. On line 11, it says a responder. I'm not sure a responder equals a volunteer.
Well,
Mr. Carlson, have you worked with Representative Abler on this language? Is this that we had an impasse here, or we just haven't had enough time to deal with this, or where are we at in the...
It's the latter. It's not having enough time to deal with this and other issues, but we're not at odds over this.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we can work this out on the way to Commerce, or on the way to local government, or on the way to Digital Finance, or on the way to Health Finance, Madam Chair.
All right, so, members, with... Let's at this point see if there's any additional questions on the bill as presented from committee members. Any additional questions at this time? Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abler, we go back to page 11. We're prescribing some actions that employers may not be able to take, and then also possibly awarding attorney's fees. And I'm just kind of wondering the thinking behind that was.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Burrell. This is an entire section on employee protection. This is, remember the situation, this isn't like today you go out in the street and there's an outbreak of the flu and some people in a town. This is like SARS, or it's a bioterrorist attack and people are falling in the streets, so they're at risk of that, like Toronto. And I didn't mention in my opening remarks that we use SARS as the index case, since there was a case where they put tens of thousands of people, 27,000 people were quarantined in Toronto, and only about 30 had a problem with it, and the rest of them stayed in their houses and it went away. And so if a person's in a quarantine, we actually made the language very narrow as to who would qualify for this protection. If you're in a quarantine because you had to go there, not because you wanted to be in a quarantine and take a month off of work. If you're in a quarantine for 21 days or less, which is some standard number that somebody thought of, then you have protection. Your job can't be taken from you. If you're a group of employers larger than 20, small employers are exempted from this. But if you're in a state of Minnesota or a 3M or somewhere, your job is safe while you're in a quarantine. It's an effort to kind of protect the worker. At the same time, you know, it's a mess. It's just a total mess. And so if you're fired because of that, then you're allowed to recover some damages because the employer didn't give you the protections that we wanted you to have. The chamber has had a very big hand in working this out, and they're comfortable with it. It's a matter of, again, you got to draw the line where you're going to protect, where you're not going to protect. We thought that employers of greater than 20 could handle a person being gone 21 days, whereas small employers of 2 employees might have a harder time bearing with you being gone. So, Madam Chair, that's Representative Burrell, that's my answer.
Thank you. Representative Abler, I'm going to have to temporarily lay this bill on the table because we do not have the right copy of the bill in our packets. We do not have the first engrossment. So we don't even have the right bill in front of us. I don't know what the changes are.
Oh.
We have a bill in front of us that, as introduced, it was re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law, and somehow think it never came to us on March 8th, but then came to us on March 11th with the first engrossment. So
I'm not going to worry about figuring it out, but I will not move the bill if we don't even have the right language in front of the committee.
Fair enough.
Given that you have the next bill on the agenda, you can stay right there in the hot seat. We'll move to House File 2724, and then hopefully we'll have copies of the bill to circle back and do 2436. So 2436 is temporarily laid on the table, and we'll take up House File 2724.
Madam Chair, it's nice to be back again for your committee.
Oh, you're so
after that
nice.
Brief hiatus. And there's an amendment. There's two amendments, Madam Chair, and I need to make an oral change to one of them.
Okay. I appear to only have one amendment in my packet, but I may be...
There's a small one to be passed out.
Can't wait.
Okay, there'll be one passed out as well. Which amendment would you like to consider?
Madam Chair, the 812, and perhaps you want to summon Representative Westrom, because he has an interest in part of this amendment. Okay, he's been sent for. Let's we'll take up the bill, and then we'll come back to his issue. Amendment 812, Madam Chair, is a compendium of a number of things. My oral amendment to Amendment 812, and perhaps Ms. McKnight to make sure I do it right. We need to strike three sections of it. We're just not
going to... Three sections?
Three sections.
Okay.
And it would be the one on page one after line three, I think it is. If Ms. McKnight agrees, that's where we would take it out. Continuing through line 20 on page two would be stricken.
Okay. Just to be... So you're deleting,
deleting.
Section nine, is that correct?
Correct.
So members, page one, lines 4 through 24... Page 2 through line 20.
And this one, I can be sure that we've done the right duty by that. The second one to delete, I think they're sequential, is on page 6 from line 14 to the rest of the page, all of page 7, all of page 8, all of page 9. Through page 10, line 16. Then I can speak to the amendment.
Wait. Okay. Just a minute.
The staff.
So you started out on page 6, line 14, all of page 7, all of page 8, all of page 9, and page 10 through line 16. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, next.
That's all.
That's all. Okay.
And then if you'd like to move the amendment to get the...
Wait.
Okay. There's that.
Members, we need to move the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The oral amendment is adopted.
And then, Madam
Representative
Chair,
Ava, do you now have the 812 amendment in the form in which you'd like it to be considered for this bill?
Madam Chair, there's one more amendment to the amendment, which will then you can adopt the amendment as a whole. There's an amendment drafted to 815 is drafted to 812. That's related to the Western issue.
All right. Members, we have an amendment that was just passed out, the 815 amendment, which is drafted to the 812 amendment. Is there a policy associated with this, or?
It'll get the amendment in order we'd like, so you can talk about the topic that's contained.
All right. Thank you, members. All those in favor of the 815 amendment say aye. 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 Those opposed, nay. The 815 amendment is adopted. Okay. We now hopefully have the 812 amendment in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. Is that true?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. I'm going to now move the 812 amendment as adopted to be incorporated into House File 2724. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Representative Abler, I think you have your bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss.
Madam Chair, I very much appreciate that. The bill before you, as amended now, is here primarily because of Article 2, which I hope you'll look over carefully. There's 40-some pages of a child protection, foster care language there, which is certainly in your purview. The amendment that you offered, that you adopted to the bill, the part on page 2 and 3 is a technical change which has to do with the dual oversight of ICFMRs, which we did some work last year, and it's a technical clarifying thing, which is kind of boring, but very interesting if you want to hear everything about it. On pages 4, 5, in the top of 6, is the Westrom bill, which you will talk about separately. And you amended that to conform to ongoing negotiations about that topic. Article 7 on page 10 of the amendment has to do with how the state can recoup payments in the case of an auto accident, which I guess is in your department, when the person's been reimbursed by another carrier. And I believe that's all the that's what the amendment did. And I think the department would be suited. If there's any questions about that, we can take those up, and the department can testify both to the last part of that amendment as well as to the Article 2, which I think would be appropriate this time, Madam Chair, to take testimony.
All right.
Article 2.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Ann Alstrom. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm speaking to Article 2. This is a department initiative, as the committee well knows. Both federal and state policy require child welfare agencies to attend to the safety of children reported as abused and neglected. Particularly, these duties include attempting to prevent out-of-home placement of a child who is abused or neglected. The agencies do this through the provision of services and supports to keep the child safely in the home. Agencies also generally must attempt reunification efforts through the provision of social services aimed at helping the parent to ameliorate unsafe conditions which led to the child's placement. And agencies must plan for the child's permanent placement away from the parent in the event reunification services are not successful in a timely fashion. Both federal and state policy require the implementation of procedures that achieve these ends, and in the case of the federal government, documentation of compliance with federal regulations relating to the services delivered to children and their families in foster care in order to receive federal reimbursement, that is, counties receive federal reimbursement for a portion of the cost of foster care, or what's commonly referred to as Title IV-E reimbursement. Article 2 seeks to improve Minnesota's compliance with federal regulations promulgated since the Adoption and Safe Families Act passed in 1997. These relate specifically to required court findings that the court must make in regard to the agency's reasonable efforts in these three areas I just talked about, that is, placement prevention, reunification, and reasonable efforts to finalize a permanent plan for the child. And that's much of what the proposed amendments to Chapter 260C relate to. Some other provisions also help agencies to appropriately calculate the time period that is in federal regulations required for permanency hearings, and those provisions are related to the definition of foster care and the proposed changes to the definition of foster care in 260C match actually the federal definition of foster care. Article 2 also conforms 260C terminology and procedures to current court rules, terminology and procedures, particularly steps the process away from delinquency, which was begun by this body, I'm going to say, in about 1998 when it separated Chapter 260 into three different chapters, Chapter 260 General Policy, Chapter 260B Delinquency, and Chapter 260C Child Welfare. So we're getting rid of things like detention because we don't detain abused and neglected children. They're taken into custody. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill, sections 1 and 2 of Article 2 relate to relative custody assistance and expand the availability of relative custody assistance for parents or relatives, who receive permanent legal and physical custody of a child in tribal court. Currently, that's not available. It has to be in district court in Minnesota. So sections 1 and 2 relate to that expanded capacity. The next sections relate to adoption and, in particular, address questions of venue in adoption cases involving state wards. Again, a state ward is a child who has lost parents through termination of parental rights. The venue provisions in 259 were designed for infant adoptions, basically, and not for contested adoptions or adoptions involving consent from the Commissioner of Human Services. The change in venue provisions allow the court that supervises the matter after termination of parental rights to continue to supervise the matter upon a filing of a petition to adopt, and allows that court, which knows the case, has likely been hearing the matter for at least 12 months at that point in time, to continue to make decisions about how the adoption matter should proceed. In those cases where the petitioner, the adoptive parent that is, lives in another county and there is no contest, the matter can be transferred there, but in all other cases, the court with ongoing responsibility continues to supervise the placement. Other issues that are addressed in Article 2 relating to adoption are reducing the time period for home studies to match that of foster care home studies from 10 years to 5 years. It eliminates fingerprinting provision because the department's information from our colleagues at the BCA is that there was no practical assistance provided through the requirement of a fingerprinting process. Probably this committee is most interested in the provisions that begin at Section 7 and relate to the provisions of findings that are required by a juvenile court. Section 7 amends the findings, clarifies them, if you will, to conform to those three outlined reasonable efforts findings I just discussed. Again, that is reasonable efforts to prevent placement, reasonable efforts to reunify, reasonable efforts to finalize a permanent plan for the child. Hopefully making the court able to make the appropriate finding at the appropriate point in the case, which will assist counties in being able to get proper reimbursement from the federal government. There are also some provisions that relate to a small category of cases that the federal government created back in 1997 with the Adoption Safe Families Act, cases where social service agencies do not have to attempt to prevent placement or to reunify. This category of case is defined in Minnesota law as egregious harm, cases where there are previous involuntary termination of parental rights or previous loss of custody in juvenile court, or cases where the court finds the provision of further reasonable efforts would not be effective and therefore would be unreasonable. The provisions in Section 7 conform those categories of cases, make them the same throughout this chapter, and in Chapter 260C it's the same list that you'll see repeated, and also clarifies that in fact when you're in that kind of a case type, so the very serious cases, the juvenile court must conduct a permanency hearing within 30 days, again matching a federal requirement to that effect. Most of the rest of the sections, well, I guess we should look at Section 11, which is the definition of foster care that I talked about. Proposed amendment to Chapter 260C. And again, the proposal by the Department of Human Services contained in this bill matches our Minnesota definition to the federal definition of foster care, and actually lists some exclusions from foster care, for instance, hospitalization or inpatient chemical dependency treatment of the child, or placement in facilities that are primarily for delinquent children, placement in corrections facilities that do not qualify for E. And again, that's to help local social service agencies who are trying to claim Title IV E properly to know what counts in that time and what doesn't count in that time. New provision at Section 16 relates to a new disposition that's called trial home visits or trial home visit. This is a provision that's currently provided for in state law. It is, in federal law. This would lay some provisions into state law which would make this federal provision usable by Minnesota counties. The advantages to having it in Minnesota law are It allows the agency, again, to maintain 4E eligibility for children who can go home and try it, if you will. I guess that's why they call it trial home visit. And if it doesn't work out, the agency does not have to reestablish 4E eligibility if it meets criteria and it's less than 6 months. Now, this definition or articulation of trial home visit goes a bit beyond federal requirements because it actually sets out procedures for what the agency can do and can't do, and that's because this is a new disposition and it clarifies that custody of the child actually remains with the agency, and if that's the case, then the agency has certain authorities and responsibility, and that's all set out in Chapter 16. Chapter 17 or Section 17 is not, most of it's not new. It relates to permanency hearings. But one of the things that is in there is the making, I'm sorry, it's not Section 17. It's Section, Section 20, pardon me, the committee, which amends permanency, the current permanency hearing provisions. What this does, first of all, is clarify the cases in which it does, permanency hearings are required, or if they're not required under this provision, which provisions they are required under. There's a ton of issue about that, both in county agencies and the court system. It also provides that when a child is in the custody of a non-custodial parent under Chapter 260C, that time does count towards permanency. It also provides that there are certain cases in which the court conducts what's called an admit-deny hearing under the court rules, and these provisions in Section 20 match the current court rule provisions in that regard. And there is a new disposition which I wanted to point out to you, which is not readily popping out in the first engrossment. It's in the first engrossment. It is actually on page 45, beginning at lines 21, lines 27. Currently, the parent in a guardianship a termination of parental rights or permanency matter can consent to adoption. That is considered a kinder way of letting parents plan for their child than going through a termination of parental rights proceeding. Again, consents to adopt generally have been in the context of infant adoptions, and so in Chapter 259, where they're provided for, a parent or a mom usually has 10 days to withdraw that consent. This provision makes a consent given at a permanency hearing irrevocable upon it being given, except in cases governed by the Indian Child Welfare Act, because federal law prohibits that. The idea is, this is a parent who's appearing in court at 12 months. They've been working with the agency. They're not going to get their child back. There's no reason to have that additional 10 days time. And, in fact, in some instances, it's been reported to the department, the parent appears, consents one day, and withdraws it the next, and then the matter has to go back on the trial calendar, causing significant delay in an award of permanency or a decision about permanency for the child. The rest of the provisions, while there's a lot of underlining, mostly relates to orders for long-term foster care and the fact that Minnesota, when we were reviewed by the federal government, was determined to have three times more children in long-term foster care than any other state. This is a cause for alarm by the feds, who are saying this is not a permanent disposition for kids. So, Department of Human Services, you must give more tools to your agencies to be able to otherwise plan. Well, of course, the ultimate determiner of long-term foster care is the court, and so many of these provisions relate to the recommendation for long-term foster care must come from the responsible agency. That is because ultimately it's the agency that has custody of the child. There's no other entity that is forced to take custody of a child through the child's minority. It's the least preferred permanency option. So from a policy standpoint, we're recommending to match the federal requirement, actually, that that can only come at the agency's recommendation or request upon approval by the court. The other thing that you'll see throughout there is some structure put in around long-term foster care reviews. 2 years ago, you added in yearly reviews for long-term foster care cases because it is a federal requirement, but there wasn't much structure in the law about what those are about. This is clear that it actually reviews the child's status in long-term foster care, asks the agency to consider whether this really continues to be the best option for the child, and if not, and if there are grounds to move to a different permanency option, to move on. Section 23 is a little change in gear, relates to the Maltreatment of Minors Reporting Act, and actually adds a provision that is required again by federal law under the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and in the first engrossment that begins at the bottom of page 57. And this provision relates to the agency's requirement to tell the alleged offender at the time that they're conducting an assessment or investigation what the allegations against them are, consistent with the laws which protect the rights of the person who made the report. Remember that reporters' names and identifying information are confidential and must be by federal law, and this meets that compliance. That's a quick and dirty summary, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Coles has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to Article 2, Section 15, I'm looking at page 26, line 32 of the bill, and maybe this is something we deleted out, but I don't think so. I think that was in the DE or in the A-12 amendment. Is that still in the bill, first of all, before I ask my question, I guess? I'm looking at the bill as it was in our packets, the first engrossment. Is that still in the bill?
Representative Coles, page 26, what line?
26, line 32.
Are you asking if the deletion is still in the bill?
No, I'm asking
new
if the new language is still in the bill. It's still before us.
All right. Representative Abler says that it was not changed.
It's still there. All right. I'm wondering if, and I'm sorry I missed your name, ma'am, but I'm wondering if you could explain to me what that language is doing, because as I read it, it says that the court shall enter a finding that the social services agency has made reasonable efforts to prevent placement when the agency establishes a couple things, but doesn't give the court any discretion there. It's prescriptive. The court shall do this. What if the court determines that reasonable efforts haven't been made, and why is that a shall as opposed to may, or requiring the court make a finding one way or the other?
Madam Chair, Representative, required finding, I would say, is optional. The idea is and always has been that reasonable efforts determinations on the part of the court are not to be a rubber stamp of the agency's statement that they have made reasonable efforts. This is in here because of a change in federal regulation that relates to the finding that reasonable efforts were made to prevent placement. And it's a semantic change in some ways, but literally when the auditors come in and look at court orders, they look to see if the court entered a finding that reasonable efforts were made to prevent placement. And what they are telling us, that is what the federal auditors are telling State Department of Human Services staff, is that finding has to be in there. It used to be that the court could enter finding reasonable efforts were not possible as an emergency existed. Reasonable efforts were made. This is an attempt to say that the correct finding is actually the wording that you see. The responsible social service agency has made reasonable efforts to prevent placement. And it would be when either of those things is established. In other words, when the agency establishes that it has actually provided services or made efforts in an attempt to prevent removal, or that such efforts were not possible under the particular circumstances of the case. And if the agency cannot establish those things, and it has to establish those things either through the sworn petition, a certified court report, or testimony in court, then the court should not be making a finding regarding reasonable efforts at all. It's absent. In the absence of a reasonable efforts finding, at this point in the case, the matter is not eligible for Title IV reimbursement. So it's the absence of a finding that's problematic for the agency. The presence of a positive finding is a good thing. It's never intended to be a rubber stamp. And in some places, and I suppose you could say whether or not the agency has made, but it seems to me it connects to the clause when the agency establishes either of the two things articulated. Does that help?
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I am concerned that the language creates a rubber stamp type, but I'm not in a position to try to fix that at this time, but I do hope and I trust that Representative Abler will be willing to either placate my concerns or work with me on an amendment.
I'm sure you will.
Madam Chair, just to...
Representative Abler.
I'm happy you're looking at different sections here. I was hoping you would look at some of these things, and if you can talk to the department and work with me, I'm sure we can make some amendments. This will go to Health, Finance, and then to the floor. So thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions?
Madam Chair, I just want to raise two issues for the committee. As best I can, there's two numbers that you might be interested in just knowing that you're changing. I don't know if they're technical or not, but you do. On page 16, line 10, you're changing a 10 to a 5, which to me seems like something I would notice if I knew this topic. And then also, whether you're talking about looking back to vulnerable adult maltreatment complaints, that these look back 10 years, they're suggesting 5, and maybe the department can talk about it. You can decide if it's a good number. I hope you have an opinion. And then also on page 51, line 11 and 12, they're making 12 into 24 months in terms of how long something should go. So at least those are numbers you would be conversant about, and as a committee you could make a decision that those are good or bad numbers. The one I'm most interested in, Madam Chair, is the first one, which is the 10 to 5 years on line 6, on page 16.
All right. Thank you, Representative Abler. Any additional questions or comments at this time? Anybody in the audience like to speak in opposition to House File 2724? If you'll step to the table and state your name for the record, please.
This is about the 4 years bill, and so what is the rest of this bill when that comes down, and Tony has been a thought.
We'll wait for the appropriate time, Madam Chair. Hold it.
We should get to it. Do you want to talk about this some more? Or are you
Representative Abler, when you're talking about Tory's bill, are you talking about the
amendment, Madam Chair?
The A-12 as amended?
That project has some county interest, and they want to talk about that.
That language has been amended onto the bill, so this would be the appropriate time to comment on that. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Megan Mose. I'm with MACSA, the County Social Service Directors Association.
Sorry, we didn't catch your name.
Sure, it's Megan, M-E-G-H-A-N, and my last name is Mose, M-O-H-S.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the opportunity just to comment briefly, and I don't want to overstate our concerns. Representative Westrom, who originally had authored the language that's now included in the A-12 amendment, and, Madam Chair, I am speaking to issues on page 4 of the A-12 amendment, starting on line 4. And while members are turning to that page, Representative Westrom really has addressed many of our concerns. I believe there was an amendment adopted a moment ago that addressed one of our concerns, and a piece of the language that involves some sanction language was taken out that we very much appreciate. And again, not to overstate it, but counties are still concerned about some language on line 7, changing as soon as possible to immediately, and on line 13, the additions of the word and comprehensive. And, Madam Chair and members, really the concerns here, there's no argument from counties about the policy of doing relative custody searches. I think we can safely say we're in absolute 100% agreement that this ought to be the policy. It ought to be done as soon as possible to the beginning of the case as possible. It's believed to be an important practice thing to do. It's the appropriate policy to follow. I think our concerns about the change to the word immediately to us just raises the question about by striking the words as soon as possible, are we saying sooner than possible? And I think in light of you know, our, sort of our responsibilities relative to child protection cases. Our only immediate responsibility currently as we see it is to safeguard, you know, the safety and welfare and health of the child and have other requirements that need to be taken care of immediately when a case begins. Certainly we don't want, you know, resources and attention diverted from those immediate concerns with a child protection case. And the other issue on line 13, and again, I don't want to overstate it because I do believe the author is working with us to try to address some of these concerns before this bill goes to Finance Committee. We certainly, you know, the best practice is to do a comprehensive search. We believe that is happening 99% of the time out in counties. And again, not to overstate it, but, you know, we certainly don't want to create a situation where a relative who is living in Nebraska comes to light, you know, 5 years down the road and alleges that the search wasn't comprehensive. And really the interest here is just trying to do what's in the best interest of the child, and that type of a case, you know, we'd have concerns about whether that would be in the best interest of the child. So I appreciate the opportunity just to share some of our concerns, and as I said, we'd be glad to work on it to see that they're addressed.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Moles? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Anybody else wish to testify on behalf of House File 2724 as amended? Any additional questions from committee members?
If Sebastian wants to come, he's on his way, Madam Chair, to comment if it's still is okay. He's he came and went. He's in room 5, so he's being brought over now. He at least wants to talk. Maybe he'll pass his bill and not be here. But
well,
what's your pleasure, Madam Chair? He's
right
on his way, I think.
Well, I'm not going to sit here doing nothing, so I'm going to put House File 2724 as amended back on the table and take up House File 2436, which is your other bill, Representative Abler. We now have the first engrossment in front of us, and we did move an amendment to the first engrossment, although we didn't have it in front of us. It was the amendment which clarified the four-year sunset. When we left this exciting story, we were having discussions with Mr. Carlson regarding some of the liability issues from the testimony that we heard. I think Representative Abler is willing to work with Mr. Carlson as this bill makes its trip to, I believe, 7 committees. And if committee members have any comments relative to those concerns to give direction to Representative Abler and Mr. Carlson, I would appreciate that now.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
For that advice, I learned a new term that I have an amendment, but that Mr. Carlson's hand moved while I thought it. And so this clarifies the vicarious official immunity that we talked about. Apparently it's good to put it in language and in words and not just on a tape buried in a vault somewhere. So if it's a pleasure to the chair, if someone would move that, if it's appropriate to bring an amendment at this time.
Okay, let's get it passed out to the committee members. Any questions on the A10 amendment, as I'm going to label it at this time? Questions? Mr. Carlson, if you just want to explain the rationale for this, the committee.
Madam Chairman and members, this simply indicates that for an action brought under this section of immunity, the judicial doctrine of vicarious official immunity would not apply, so that you actually have liability in the event that there is a compensable claim. And we did also, Madam Chair, on line 19, suggest in the titling changing Good Samaritan to responder.
Mr. Carlson, I don't see that in your amendment.
I didn't handwrite this one, so I didn't notice that it wasn't on there as well. That's why I'm going to just try and run through it. We only have two other.
Okay, let's deal with one thing at
okay,
one time.
No problem.
Committee members, we have the A10 amendment in front of us. Representative Cole.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I missed the discussion earlier. If was there a discussion about what vicarious official immunity and what that doctrine is? Did the committee have that discussion?
Mr. Carlson had some concerns, and Mr. Carlson, I bet, can give you the Cliff Note version of our discussion.
Madam Chairman, Representative Coles, if there is liability to the individual, that can extend vicariously to the municipality, and we're just trying to ensure that that isn't the situation here.
Representative Coles.
Thank you.
Are there any additional questions on the A-10 amendment? All those in favor of the A-10 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
The A-10 amendment is adopted.
Ma'am.
Mr. Carlson, you're also stating that you want the title of that section changed instead of Good Samaritan.
Of the first engrossment, Madam Chair, on line 19 on the head note, we would delete Good Samaritan and insert responder.
What page?
I'm sorry.
Page four.
Page four.
Ms. McKnight, would that be it conform with what the changes that we've made in that section?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, you can see later in this section six. This is the head note to section six. You can see the word responder, for example, on line 32 of that page. I think it probably appears other places, so it would work.
Okay, so members, if I'm correct, on line page four, line 19, delete Good Samaritan. And insert responder. Is that correct?
And then, Madam Chairman, on page 5, line 1, put a period after order and delete the balance of line 1, all of 2, 3, and 4.
And Representative Abler, is the department okay with this recommendation?
Madam Chair, it seems reasonable, and I think that we might not need to talk on the way to Commerce after this, so I think they'll be done.
All right. Members, again, that would be page 4, line 19, delete Good Samaritan, insert responder, page 5, line 1 after order, delete the remainder of line 1, 2, 3, and 4. Any questions? Representative Biernat.
Madam Chair, maybe for Mr. Carlson, what if the responder acts in a willful, wanton, reckless manner? I mean, there's absolutely no liabilities, it's pure immunity?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and President Biernat, no. If you look on page 4 on lines 33, 34, and 35, that would not be acting in good faith, and they would not be immune from any liability.
Any additional questions on the oral amendment? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I think, was actually for Mr. Carlson and maybe the author. I'm going back to my concern about employers are held to some different standard than the rest of the state, I think. And I guess my question is, they're all over the law. You have 10 days to do this, you have 45 days to do that, 30 days to do this. And I'm wondering if you take a school system or you take a court system and you put it in quarantine, is there some liability to relieve all the other legal deadlines that occur in our legal system by the people who are placed in quarantine? How does this affect all the legal deadlines from foreclosure on your house to paying your rent, being evicted, not responding to a summons, you know?
Paying your taxes.
On and on and on. Yeah.
Representative Abler.
This is an effort to carve out simply employee protection relative to their job. There's no other provision to exempt any other deadline or duty that they have. And that could be a bill you might want to offer next year. Or you're not going to come back. You better make an amendment now, Representative Burrell.
We're not doing any more amendments on this bill. We're going to vote it up or down on the shape. And
that's the intention, Madam Chair, to carve out employee protection specifically.
But I think Roseanne Burrell does have an interesting point. If the government has quarantined somebody to the point where they're not able to conduct their regular business, then I think there are some issues there, and maybe in the meantime, before this bill goes through the remaining six committees into the floor, we can look at some language to address that. Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, I guess I'm actually suggesting that if you are put in this emergency quarantine, that all other legal deadlines should be superseded put on hold until the end of the quarantine period. And I guess I'd like Mr. Carlson's take on that because it's so pervasive in our law.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Burrell, that is one of a number of issues that have been raised about the quarantine issue, and people have struggled with that. We do have certain provisions. I'm sure you could pattern them off of protections that we have for people who are called into active military service, where they get some protection and relief on certain things, including their mortgage. But that has been an ongoing problem, and we share that concern.
Thank you. Any other brief questions by committee members?
Madam Chair, just one comment.
Representative Abler.
Just to the policy of the quarantine.
Madam Chair, the average expectation for a quarantine period would be a two-week time period, so it's not comparable, I don't think, to the military issue.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We just better hope there won't be a disaster on April 10th. So, anyway, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2436, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Representative Abel, you're on your way to Commerce Committee. Good luck.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is Representative Westrom in the room?
I'm right here.
Oh, that's a good thing. We're going to take House File 2724 off the table because... Basically, Representative Abler said you wanted to come and make comment. I would caution you that I think your bill is about ready to move through here.
Just say hello.
So, hi.
5 words.
So, if you keep your comments brief, Representative West.
Madam Chair, I'm here for questions.
My question might be is why you chose to team up with Representative Abler, but we're not going to go there right now.
Representative Abler was a good rower in the boat, and I thought it was just as easy to have him carry it along as to go on its own because he's got other adoption issues and other health HHS.
I would assume that Representative Abler would be willing to give you all the details of the enlightening discussion that we had regarding his bill. Are there any questions for Representative Westrom? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2724, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Thank you, gentlemen. You're on your way to Health and Human Service Finance.
Sorry, I hope
thank you. Representative Strand, House File 1593. Hmm? Welcome to the committee, Representative Strand. If you, let's see, you're going to Judiciary Policy and Finance, I understand?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And you have a partner today as well.
I do. We like to team up.
All right. Welcome to the committee. All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lindner. Lindgren, I'm sorry. I'll move House File 1593 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Policy Finance. And if you'd like to explain your bill.
Certainly. And Madam Chair, if I could you also move the 1149 amendment to get the bill in the order that we need?
Certainly. The bill author would like amendment 1149 adopted to get the bill in the shape you'd like to discuss it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The 1149 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I should mention that this is the first bill I have in front of Chair Holberg, who is my district mate and good friend, and I beseech her to be kind with me today. This bill, House File 1593, addresses a serious public safety concern, and I'll just be very brief. The problem is a growing number of dangerous exotic animals in the hands of private owners in our state. We are one of the few states that has no regulations of wild animals at all. There are no agencies that keep track of exotic animals as pets. Now, the delete all amendment and the amendment you just adopted is the way the legislature should work on an issue that is a hot-button topic where people have strong feelings on either side. We have worked very, very hard on this to reach a compromise. There was a different bill sort of on the other side of the fence that Representative Lindgren authored. We've worked together, and I'm here today, committee members, to let you know that this bill is in the shape it should be in. And I already did that. I just did that one, yeah. And you have the packet in front of you, by the way, about the sampling of pictures from the USDA licensed facilities in Minnesota. It talks also about letters of support of the bill and a small sampling of the hundreds of ads on the internet, publications, and newspapers. The estimate right now is there's about 15,000 privately owned tigers in the U.S. They're pretty easy to buy. I'm not going to go through all the example of incidents of problems with exotic animals. We did that in ag policy. If you want to hear more about that, I'd be happy to do that with the testifier if you wish. The bottom line is wild animals are not pets. They are wild. They will revert to their natural state, and there's so many instances where that has happened. And there's also a lot of problems with disease, rabies, herpes, B virus, hepatitis that are carried by wild animals who cannot be vaccinated for rabies. And an important point is this, that there's a new federal law that just passed within the last couple of months that bans interstate selling of large exotic animals such as tigers, leopards, and lions, which means that that creates even a greater onus for us to sort of get ahead of the curve before Minnesota has all these animals unregulated within our state. As I mentioned, this bill you have before you is a compromise bill. Again, a lot of issues between the two sides here. We've worked them all out, and I brought along with me the author of the other bill, Representative Lindgren, who will just briefly talk about what the bill does.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Lindgren.
Madam Chair, members, and this is truly what the legislature does here with my friend Steve Strand here. We took two bills and we worked very feverishly to come out with one bill that does what both sides want to do. They say a good compromise is when neither side is truly happy, and that's what we have. So this is truly a good compromise, and this has to do with registering and regulating exotic animals. And like I said, we've worked hard at to get this done, and that has been accomplished on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Strand.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I think I neglected to ask that the first delete all amendment be offered and passed as well. That'd be the 1115A delete all amendment.
What was the number of the amendment again?
A04-1115A.
Okay. Members, we have that amendment in our packet. And given that we moved the 1149 amendment to the first engrossment of 1593, I'm a little perplexed as what I need to do now.
Madam Chair, the amendment we adopted is to the delete all.
We're figuring that out right now. So, Ms. McKnight, get me out of the dead end I'm at right now.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I hadn't realized that the delete amendment hadn't been moved. Maybe what you want to do is move it and then just readopt the shorter amendment to the delete, or you can have the author incorporate it in his delete. I think either one of those would get you out of it.
All right. Thank you for your advice. Members, I'm going to move the 1115A delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. I will now move the 1149 amendment to the delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay, I think we're in better shape right now.
I apologize for the confusion, Madam Chair.
Oh, we thrive on it here.
That is all we have, Madam Chair, unless there are
any questions for the bill authors. Representative Biernet.
Madam Chair, I guess this bill is kind of like a moving target, and it's had a lot of changes. I wonder if the author or authors can explain exactly what kind of regulation is left on the sale of these animals, not just possession, but the sale of these
Representative
animals.
Strand.
Madam Chair, with your permission, can I have Tammy Quist answer that question?
Certainly. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Quist. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Tammy Quist, and I'm the founder of the Wildcat Sanctuary. As with the two amendments adopted today, how, in a recap, this is that what it does is it will regulate current private owners that have these as pets to come into compliance with USDA standards. It still does allow businesses that are licensed under the USDA to sell these animals to currently registered with this bill, current registration, people that have these animals as pets and want a replacement animal, or to other USDA facilities or AZA-accredited zoos.
Representative Biernet.
Madam Chair, the material we have show, you know, the want ad showing monkeys and so on. Now, what does this do? Because we also have a handout about you can still sell these pets in Minnesota. Is Bill covering these incidents, or is it not covering all these?
Ms. Quist. Madam Chair, Representative, yes, this bill will not allow for any new private owners that are not grandfathered into this bill to purchase these dangerous animals as pets.
Any additional questions? Does anybody in the audience like to speak in opposition to House File 1593? All right. I will renew my motion that House File 1593, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you for your patience, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Nice. Next item on the agenda is House File 2987, Representative Tinglestad, and I understand we have a Senate file in front of us today.
Madam Chair, yes.
We'll lay the House bill aside, and we'll be acting on the Senate file today. So I will move approval of Senate File 2065 to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This bill before us today is a pretty technical bill that's narrowly written, and actually it's on the consent calendar in the Senate right now. Basically, it amends the definition of municipality for the local government tort law, and it adds to this term unlimited partnership in which a community action agency is the sole general partner. I know of no opposition to this bill today, and with me today is Patrick McFarland, as well as Joanne Wright from the Anoka County Community Action Program. So I'd like to turn it over to them.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Tinglestad. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patrick McFarland. I'm Executive Director of Anoka County Community Action Program in Blaine, Minnesota. And I'm here in my capacity as Director and also as Vice Chair of the Minnesota Community Action Association. I'd like to make just a couple brief comments and then answer any questions that you might have. Community action agencies are broad-based human service delivery systems. They can be organized as either units of government or 501c3s. CAPS are afforded tort limit liability protection under Minnesota Statute 466, and many are insured with Minnesota County Insurance Trust. Many CAP agencies are involved in developing and operating affordable housing. Several years ago, MCIT reinsurers determined that rental housing funded by the federal tax credit program were ineligible for tort limit liability protection because of IRS requirements that these be organized as partnerships. As part of the funding source, you had to organize partnerships separately for each of these housing projects. Therefore, MCIT could not insure the partnerships, and these projects had to be separately insured. This basically caused us to double insure all these projects and increased our costs dramatically. The federal tax credits are a major, some would say only, source of federal financing for affordable housing these days. This is part of the Minnesota CAP Association legislative package. There's no opposition that we're aware of. It'll save ACAP. If this bill is enacted, it'll save ACAP alone about $120,000 per year and about $1 million throughout the state of Minnesota in reduced insurance premiums. I wanted to say that the tort limit protection that we're asking for does not extend to the partners. It only extends to the partnership. The partnership is a special entity that's designed to own the project for the tax credits. And this will streamline and simplify our insurance and get us down to one carrier as opposed to the three or four that we currently have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McFarland. Are there any questions for Mr. McFarland? All right. So, Ms. Wright, did you have anything you'd like to add today?
Yes.
Ms. Chairman, I'm Joanne Wright. I'm the Multifamily Housing Director for ACAP. And my comments are limited to the importance of this action. We manage only affordable housing. We are serving individuals and families in Anoka County with some of the lowest incomes in the county. And the insurance costs have risen dramatically. We're talking about sevenfold over a four-year period, and it is jeopardizing our ability to deliver this housing to the people that we are supposed to be serving. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Wright? Anybody in the audience like to speak in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Biernet.
Just kind of a follow-up on the last witness. As you mentioned, it's going to save $1 million for all the CAP agencies, but would that push the cost on the others for the insurance? Would that cause affordable housing to go up because the insurance company is going to look for some kind of deep pocket here or some source of revenue here for protection?
Mr. McFarland.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we don't think so. The fact of the matter is that right now we're essentially double insuring all these projects. Most of the caps are involved in the Minnesota County's insurance trust pool. That's a self-insurance pool. So our rates will actually, for the caps, would go down. I'm not an expert in this area, so I don't know what the impact would be to other people, but this is such a small piece of the total pie in terms of the insurance industry that I can't imagine that it would be more expensive. I might also say, Madam Chair, that we are did pass the Senate. We are the consent calendar in the Senate. And we went through the Judiciary Committee and had a unanimous vote.
Thank you. Any additional questions? All right. Mr. Carlson, did you want to speak on this issue?
Madam Chairman, Joel Carlson for the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. I've been asked to speak. Only to say that we support this bill. I don't want to attach an anchor to it and have our support be a problem. We did support it. We understand the issue and have no objection to it.
All right. Thank you. Any additional questions, comments? All right. I'll renew my motion that Senate File 2065 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye. I oppose nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very
much,
Representative Engelstad. Representative Erickson, House File 2453. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps you would move this bill for me.
I'd be happy to. I see you're going to the General Register, so I'll move House File 2453. Be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 2453 authorizes the recovery of attorney fees by funeral providers in actions to recover costs of services. And to explain the bill is Paul Cassidy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cassidy. If you'd state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard, and we are legislative counsel to the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. Basically, Madam Chair, this bill stems from an increasing problem, both in rural and urban areas, of individuals not paying for their funeral goods and services after the fact. This seems to be an increasing trend, especially in rural areas, and it can be a big financial hit if you are a rural funeral provider who may only do one or two funerals a week. You can tell that it doesn't take long for a $5,000 to $8,000 funeral service bill to start adding up when you have to start writing off bad debts. The current system for collecting those debts does not always fit the funeral provider mold. For example, a funeral that cost $8,000 may in fact be too big for a small claims court claim, but too small for a funeral provider to want to go into district court with an attorney and with the prospect of having to try and recoup those attorney's fees. It may not be worth their while. This becomes a deterrent for those funeral providers who might otherwise have a valid claim. But this legislation may not be a panacea to cure all of these bad debts, but it may give some directive to the court system from the legislature. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions of the bill author or her witness? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cassidy, it
it's relatively rare in Minnesota law to have attorney's fees awarded in contract cases. How does it differ for a funeral provider than for a rural doctor or rural hospital or rural ambulance service? We had homeowners with mold problems. This committee didn't require mandatory attorney's fees in those horrendous cases as well. So can you make the case why a funeral provider should be treated differently than pretty much every other claimant?
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh. I think part of the difference in particular, first of all, I think there are some examples in Minnesota law with contracts, but I think the big difference is for funeral providers, when a funeral provider goes to the table with someone who has lost a loved one or a family member, they basically enter into a contract and a handshake and a signature. Some of these cases, even though in the contracts they've had provisions that provide for attorney's fees in the event that you don't pay for those debts, have been thrown out by some judges just saying they simply were fine print and people were bereaved at the time and the debt goes unpaid. I think that's really where the difference is.
Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cassidy, is this language on lines 10 and 11, the phrase is entitled to cost disbursements and reasonable attorney's fees, is that to be read may be awarded or shall be awarded?
May be awarded.
Mr. Cassidy.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, may be awarded.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, just on first glance, reading is entitled to doesn't appear to me to mean may be awarded. We might want to clarify the language here. If it's may be awarded, let's put may be awarded.
Yeah, over there, that's acceptable.
Okay, so let's see. Ms. McKnight, if you'll work on what the exact amendment would be while we take the opposition testimony from Mr. Carlson, we'll try and keep moving here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For your record, Joel Carlson. Not necessarily opposed to the legislation that's before you, but you know, we have on numerous occasions brought issues to the Capitol where there is an injustice to a consumer who is unable to recover attorney's fees under their contract. And we don't really see a distinction between a funeral provider or anyone else. And we have very consistently been opposed to fee shifting. And particularly, we read this as a mandatory fee shift against a consumer or a non-prevailing party unless the legislature is intending to promote some specific public purpose. Where it's conduct you're trying to control. And if this activity were a consumer fraud where you were defrauding this particular business to obtain these services, I can see authorizing an action under Chapter 8.31. But the inconsistency with the number of consumers who have issues that where fees are not contract fees are not awarded or allowed, nor have we been able to get them authorized or allowed. We just don't know that we've made a case that this a case has been made that this is one of those instances where the conduct is so prevalent and the conduct on behalf of the consumer so egregious that it requires a fee shift. I'm sympathetic to the problem, but I'm also sympathetic to the number of areas where we don't allow this, where the conduct is much more egregious and the damages are much more significant. That would be our comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. McKnight, you have the language to change it into a may.
Madam Chair and members, to make the award clearly discretionary, it would be page 1, line 10, delete is. Page 1, line 11, delete entitled to, and insert may be awarded.
Okay. Line 10. Delete the word is, line 11, delete entitled to, insert on line 10 after the word chapter may be awarded. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Viernat.
Just some comment. Again, we're just trying to fill up another statute book by adding language that this is very, very discretionary. A judge may do this, a judge may not do this, and so the impact of this bill is pretty speculative and actually totally meaningless.
I think I had a bill like that in transportation policy.
Unless you're a judge. Unless you're a judge.
Members, any additional questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I'd be happy to work with Joel Carlson if there are ways that this language can be improved.
All right. Well, let's try and adopt the oral amendment first. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. So we have the bill as amended in front of the committee. Any additional questions? Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the author, for Mr. Cassidy, a funeral provider fails to comply with the chapter, and the claimant has a claim against the funeral provider. Can they get costs and disbursements and attorney's fees? Or would you object to them getting costs and disbursements and attorney's fees?
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Representative, we would not be opposed to that.
Okay. Maybe then for Ms. McKnight, if you could grab the corollary. The author and the witness have been...
Representative Adkins, we just can't put loser pays. Would that work?
I don't think so.
Then drop funeral provider.
Representative Smith.
From Mr. Carlson, does that oral amendment being attached assuage your trouble at all, or does that fix it?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, it certainly makes it discretionary to the court. They have that ability right now if a litigant is acting in some type of bad faith. However, I don't know that you would necessarily have that in a debt collection action. Does it help? Yes. Should this apply to other contract actions as a matter of policy? I think that's the question I'm trying to get the committee to focus on.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
I just want to make sure that when I listened to Ms. McKnight that she did read may be awarded and did delete is and entitled to. Is
that's,
that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson. Ms. McKnight, would you like to take a short break? Or?
No, Madam Chair, I think I have something for you to try out. This is assuming, as I understand, the idea is a loser pays concept, and I'm going to assume that you want to keep the requirement that's in the bill now that the funeral provider recovers, if they prevail, only if they otherwise complied with the requirements of this mortuary science chapter. So with that in mind, and maybe that's not your intention, but let's start out with that in mind. On page 1, line 9, you would delete funeral provider and insert party. And then I think to make it grammatically more successful, we would try page 1, line 12, we'll delete the second the, that's the before funeral provider, and insert a. And then after provider on that line, insert who prevails may recover only if the funeral provider, and then continue. So the sentence now, in addition to the other amendment that was adopted, would read, a party who prevails in an action for the recovery of fees for services provided under this chapter may be awarded cost, disbursements, and reasonable attorney fees incurred in the action, provided that a funeral provider who prevails may recover only if the funeral provider otherwise complied with the requirements of this chapter in connection with the provision of those services.
And Madam Chair, that is one sentence.
There are far too many providers and provisions, but I don't think we can try to fix that now.
That'll be in the report.
You want to move that?
Sure.
Representative Atkins moves that oral amendment. Any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, if this language prevails, I want to work with Mr. Knight to see if we can maybe make it sound a little bit.
We'll have the meeting of the English teacher and the attorney. That should be fun.
She and I worked together before. So.
All right, members, we have the, albeit rather rough, amendment moved by Representative Atkins. Any questions? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Then we're on the bill as amended. Any additional comments or questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2453 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register with the notion that there may possibly be a better way to write this piece of legislation. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next item on the
and thank you, Ms. McKnight.
All right, thank you. Next item on the agenda is House File 2020. Representative Walker, you've been so patient. Representative Walker, welcome to the committee. I tried to get you up here when Representative Abler and Westrom were here, and my committee administrator tells me that she wanted to move this separately still, so we're happy to do that for you, but I thought that we might have been able to move you through a little earlier. So
thank you, Madam Chair, and members for hanging in there. This actually just got amended on Representative Abler's bill. The bill itself was heard with testimony in Health and Human Service Policy last week. Representative Westrom's bill, we decided to amend my particular bill on his bill. And then I found out today that Westrom and Abler decided to amend that on that bill. However, because it is a department omnibus bill, I feel more comfortable it's traveling alone, making sure that it's safeguarded. It's actually on the General Registry in the Senate, and just want to move this along also.
All right, thank you. I have a similar bill, the exact same thing that I'm doing on a DBS bill. So, members, are there any questions? As Representative Walker stated, this language is actually part of the first Abler bill that we moved earlier. All right, I would like to move House File 2020 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Any questions? All those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you,
Madam Chair,
Representative Walker. Members, we are not having a committee hearing tomorrow. Yahoo, cheer. Members, we are not having a committee hearing tomorrow. Yahoo, cheer. Yippee, skippy. But we will be here Friday morning. We're going to start promptly at 8 a.m. And at this point, it looks like we may have two or three bills on the agenda and be done in rather short order. Unfortunately, my committee administrator brought up a new issue that we should deal with. This is in relation to the Bradley bill with the open meeting law and the Disability Council, the ability for people to hold open meetings with the telephone, people not in attendance. The bill was moved to civil law on March 8th, so we should have had it in our possession. For some reason, it was moved again to civil law on another day. It never got to us when it was supposed to move on the 8th, and consequently, it arrived on yesterday. And so technically we never had the green jackets on Friday, so I'm asking that we move to reconsider. Can I just move it?
Move it, table it.
Just move it again? Okay, so I need to make a motion today, now that the bill is actually in our possession, that House File 2691 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And this is the Bradley bill. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. House File 2691 is hopefully really on its way to the General Register at this point. Any questions? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.